been up at street level since he'd stepped aboard the maglev train at the Boston South Station. The hotel lobby was quieter, less crowded. Dex glanced at his wristwatch and saw that he was running several minutes late. He looked around the lobby, peaceful and nearly empty at this time of the morning. There was Anderson standing in front of the men's shop window looking at a display of Italian silk jackets. Dex shook his head. Quentin Anderson didn't look like the sharpest publicist in New York. He was grossly overweight, his face florid and sheened with perspiration, his multiple chins lapping down over the wilted collar of his tailor-made shirt, his unbuttoned coat sagging around him like the flag of a defeated battalion. An Italian silk jacket won't do him any good, Dex thought. Rumor had it that Anderson was dying of cancer, but that rumor was at least 10 years old, and the man was still at the peak of his profession. Walking up next to him, Dex muttered an apology for being late. A train was held up coming out of Boston. Anderson smirked.
Jesse James rides again?
No. A demonstration that blocked the tracks. Something about protest against the church and state separation, said Anderson.
I heard about it.
He's got his ear to the ground, Dex said to himself. The lean, handsome mannequin wearing the silk jacket suddenly stirred to life, raising one hand and asking, "Would you like to try something on, sir?" Dex was startled, but Anderson chuckled as he pointed.
Sensor set into the window alongside the speaker. You stop for more than 30 seconds and the program activates.
We have an excellent selection of... Anderson turned and started walking away from the window. Dex followed him.
Uses technology your people developed for Mars, I bet you,
Anderson said, still laughing quietly at Dex's surprise.
Hasn't that gotten to Boston yet?
Don't know, said Dex. I shop electronically. I haven't been inside a store in ages. As they walked slowly across the hotel lobby, Dex asked,
Speaking of Mars, what about our documentary? Will you manage the publicity campaign for it?
Afraid not. Anderson lowered himself slowly into one of the lobby's plush armchairs. To Dex, it looked like a massive load of cargo being carefully deposited by an invisible crane. Taking the chair next to him, Dex pressed,
You want more money?
Money's not an issue, Mr. Trumbull. Dex could feel his brows knitting. Look, we need somebody who can stir up a buzz about our documentary. It's on the Internet, but we're hardly getting any hits on it. Anderson said nothing.
We've got a priest from the Vatican talking about Mars, for Christ's sake. The controversy alone ought to be newsworthy, but the goddamn networks won't touch it.
Can't say I blame them.
What's that supposed to mean?
Anderson turned his fleshy face toward Dex.
Mr. Trumbull, the word is out. Every mother-loving church in the country just about has told its congregation not to look at your documentary.
That ought to make people run to see it, Dex said. The kids especially.
You wish. The faithful go home from church and block your documentary so that their precious little darlings can't access it.
But that's illegal. It's against the First Amendment. Anderson pulled out a huge white handkerchief and ran it under his collar as he explained,
The First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting freedom of expression. It doesn't say diddly squat about faithful, God-fearing citizens doing it on their own volition.
Their own volition, Dex snapped.
They're a bunch of brainless automatons. That mannequin in the store window has more intelligence than they do.
The mannequin's not watching your show either. Feeling desperate, Dex urged,
That's why we need you. We need to create some buzz about the documentary, make noise about it, get people curious enough to look at it.
But Anderson shook his head, a slow, ponderous back-and-forth wobbling of all that flesh.
You're flogging a dead horse, Mr. Trumbull. The churches are against you. Even the Catholic parishes have told their people not to watch it. I'm not going to go against that kind of tide. It'd be suicide. I'd just be taking your money under false pretenses.
You're just going to let the new morality push our documentary into oblivion?
You got to know when to hold 'em and know when to fold 'em.
Anderson struggled to his feet.
Sorry you had to come down from Boston just to hear bad news, Mr. Trumbull. But believe me, I've looked at all the angles. Your documentary is a dead issue. Maybe some private schools will look at it, but don't expect a big audience.
Dex muttered a heartfelt, Damn. As he watched Anderson waddle off through the hotel lobby, Dex knew that his worst fears had been realized.
The New Morality and their fellow fundamentalists were working hard to strangle the exploration of Mars. He had only one card left to play. With a sigh, he pulled out his pocket phone and called for his limo. He wasn't looking forward to riding through the choking traffic all the way out to JFK Airport. But Kinnear was in Hawaii, and if Dex was going to close a deal for bringing tourists to Mars, he had to go to Kinnear. "I'll get it all signed and sealed," he told himself as he impatiently waited for the limo to show up. "I won't breathe a word of this to Jamie until the money's on the table." Tithonium Chasma, the Cliff Dwellings. "Fulvio, are you all right?" Jamie asked, alarmed. He could hear the priest's labored breathing and the headphone clipped to his ear.
"Yes," DiNardo answered, puffing. "I'm just a little out of breath."
They had ridden side by side up the cable lifts from the valley floor to the cleft where the ancient building stood. It had taken DiNardo 3 floundering tries to get his boots on the floor of the cleft. In the end, Jamie had to throw him a tether and reel him in. Through the inflated helmet of DiNardo's nanofabric suit, Jamie could see the priest's face was flushed, whether from exertion or embarrassment he couldn't tell. "I have never been a mountaineer," DiNardo said with an apologetic smile as he unclipped the climbing harness. "It's my fault," Jamie said. "We pushed you through without all the necessary training."
"I'm all right now. I simply needed to catch my breath."
Jamie nodded and held out one hand as if to steady his companion. DiNardo looked past him, and his mouth sagged open.
"This is it," he whispered, eyes widening.
Jamie felt himself break into a broad smile. "This is it. The Cliff Dwellings." The structures stood ghostly pale against the ruddy tones of the overhanging rock, but straight and clean-lined, created by an intelligence that knew how to build for the ages. As they began to walk toward the buildings, Jamie went on, "Carlton says they weren't dwellings. The Martians lived down on the valley floor. These buildings were some sort of temple, he believes, used for ceremonial purposes."
"They came here to worship?"
"Maybe." They ducked through a low doorway and straightened up again inside the building. Sunlight filtered down from the light well that ran through the core of the structure.
"Do you think this was truly a place of worship?" DiNardo asked, his voice hardly above a whisper.
Heading for the ladder that led to the upper floors, Jamie said, "The Anasazi back in Arizona built storehouses for grain high up in rock clefts. They used the sites for protection against their enemies."
"Did these Martians have enemies among them?"
"Damned if I know." DiNardo chuckled softly.
"Be careful of the words you speak. I had a teacher, a stern old Irish Jesuit, who always warned us that we should not use such language. God might grant your wish and damn you for all eternity, he would tell us."
"I couldn't believe that God would be so spiteful," said Jamie.
"Neither could I," said Monsignor DiNardo.
Then, after a moment's hesitation,
"Yet he did away with the Martians, did he not?"
Jamie looked at the priest. His face was etched with something beyond the kind of burning desire to know that drove Jamie. His eyes looked infinitely sad. Vijay, meanwhile, was in the midst of a tutorial by Carter Carlton. She had deliberately sought him out at lunch and found him at a table with 8 others. They made room for Vijay to sit across the table from Carlton, between a professor of geophysics and a postdoc cellular biologist. Carlton spent the mealtime discussing the work at the dig, although he did almost all the talking while the others listened and nodded.
"He's handsome," Vijay thought. "Handsome and basking in the attention everyone's giving him."
4 of the 8 others were women, 3 of them quite young. Vijay memorized their names from the tags on the coveralls and made a mental note to check their dossiers.
"It's all part of my psych profiling," she told herself. "I've got to know everyone's background as thoroughly as I can."
But it was Carlton who fascinated her. She had looked up his file as soon as she had gotten Nari Quintana's agreement for the psychology study. Carlton was by far the most interesting personality among the scientists and technicians. He had been chairman of the University of Pennsylvania's anthropology department, but had resigned under a cloud of accusations and recrimination. Vijay had pulled up news media reports of the scandal. A female student